political campaigns have been ratcheting up as it is a day before the general election. Senator Brian Schatz stopped by our studios earlier to talk about what's to come.
We're cautiously optimistic. I think after 2016, a lot of us have gotten out of the prediction business. I just don't know what's going to happen. But it does look good for us to take back the United States House. And a lot of enthusiasm is sort of washing over House districts, and not just in sort of Clinton districts, but a lot of suburbs that are normally Republican and even exurban districts across the country. Steve King is in peril. Lots of the most Republican districts in the country with incumbents are actually having to fight for their political lives. So there's definitely something happening across the country. On the Senate side, because so many of my colleagues are running for re-election in states that Trump won, it's going to be a very, very hard road to take the Senate. And I would be not thrilled, but I would be satisfied if we just sort of held our own, because this is really literally the worst Senate map in a generation.
And I'm intrigued just to hear how many people from Hawaii have flown to the mainland to help out in some of these tricky states.
It's extraordinary. We've been able to work with the Democratic Party and lots of grassroots organizations, labor unions, the Indivisible Group, and they are phone banking for Nevada, phone banking for Arizona at the South Street headquarters of the Democratic Party. We just sent out a bunch of texts over the last 8 to 10 days, and we have 30 people that will be in Montana on Election Day to serve as poll watchers and election observers, because there's sort of a lot of shenanigans going on, especially in terms of Native American Indian country and preventing people from being able to vote. So we have 30 people from Hawaii, or at least affiliated with my office, as volunteers who are going to be in Montana to make sure that everybody's vote is counted. So that's really exciting. And it was just a matter of sending a bunch of texts. A lot of them are already there, but some of them are leaving in the next couple of days. And it's even for Montana, it's a little colder than usual. So it's funny. It's snow is falling already. I've been getting texts with little pictures of snow.
Okay. And I know I did check with the Democratic Party, and they were sending more than a dozen people out there. Texas and Nevada.
Yeah, Nevada is a big one for us, because it's probably our best opportunity to pick up a seat. Jackie Rosen is a great candidate. She came to Hawaii to campaign a little, and we were able to support her. But obviously, the Hawaii Nevada connection is strong with Las Vegas. A lot of former Hawaii residents are there. There's a huge Asian community in Vegas, in Clark County. So we're trying to mobilize over there. And obviously, I encourage anybody who knows people in Las Vegas to support the Democrat if they are so inclined.
And so what's at stake here for Hawaii in this election?
Well, for Hawaii, it's about making sure we protect our values and our interests. On the appropriation side, we're confident that we're going to be able to work together on a bipartisan basis, regardless of who controls the House and the Senate, because we've been able to make sure that federal funds continue to flow. But everything that we care about in terms of being decent to each other, in terms of climate change, in terms of Native Hawaiian rights, in terms of civility, in terms of LGBTQ issues, in terms of immigration, everything that we value and cherish is on the ballot. And it occurs to me over the last 2 weeks, you know, I've been kind of monomaniacal about making sure that people finish with a message of anti-corruption and protecting your health care. But there is one more thing, which is that to the extent that Donald Trump is finishing with a message that is nearly explicitly racist, it's worse than the Willie Horton ads that caused people to be shocked and offended, you know, many decades ago. This is really worse than that. And it's coming from the president of the United States. So now it's not about how you feel about the Affordable Care Act or how high you think the, you know, top marginal tax rate should be. This is about who we are as a country and whether we're willing to rebuke and repudiate a political party that is willing to close with a message of essentially, you ought to be afraid of other Americans. Even if you're a Republican, you have to find that closing message to be alarming and abhorrent.
And we've got this thing happening along our borders. He is putting troops out to, in anticipation of this caravan of immigrants that's moving toward Mexico and to the U.S. borders. How are you looking at that?
Well, it's a stunt. I mean, these people are unarmed. They are mostly women and children. They are fleeing violence, and they are 1,000 miles away and moving roughly 18 miles a day on foot. They are not a danger to our country. So the idea that we would mobilize any United States Army soldiers for this purpose is preposterous. And they moved from the idea of 800 soldiers to 5,000 soldiers to 7,500 soldiers to several brigades now, 15,000 soldiers, which is an extraordinary number of troops, boots on the ground, on our southern border to protect us from 1,000 or so people who are seeking asylum. And let's just be clear, the process for seeking asylum does not enable these people to sort of breach our borders. They have to be adjudicated. And a lot of them will not be granted asylum. And those that get asylum will be safe and secure and good members of our society. So, you know, here's where I take some comfort and some solace. The Republicans' main policy objectives were the tax cut, which they were able to enact, and repealing the Affordable Care Act, which they were famously unable to enact because of John McCain's no vote. Neither of those things are their closing message. And so from my perspective, what that demonstrates is that the things that they've done and the things that they want to do are unpopular. And so they're basically closing with, you ought to be afraid of these people who are not Caucasian, who are 1,000 miles away, and who are moving towards our borders at the rate of 15 miles a day on foot. And therefore, what I'm going to do is get 15,000 Army soldiers to turn their guns on them. And I want to be precise with my language. Donald Trump said that his instructions were to the DOD, if they throw a rock, you should take it as though it is a gun. And that is a violation of the Uniform Code of Military Justice. That is a violation of civil rights and human rights. And it is, more importantly, a violation of everything that it means to be an American soldier. That would be an unlawful order. And I think we have to expect that President Trump is going to ratchet up the rhetoric and get more and more outrageous over the next 4 or 5 days. So although we want to point that out, we also don't want to be pushed off of our message, which is essentially that there is a corrupt establishment in Washington, D.C., and that there needs to be checks and balances. There needs to be a divided government to provide a check against this president, and that we're going to fight for things that matter to people, like health care and education.
We have heard calls for the president to tone down his rhetoric.
I have given up on the idea that Donald Trump will tone down his rhetoric. I don't think he can be shamed. I think he thinks this works for him. I think this, you know, there's an old saying in politics, which is everybody keeps rerunning their first race until it stops working. So especially if you've never been in politics and you win the highest office in the land, the highest office really on the planet in a certain way, you know, you're going to keep running that play until it stops working. And so the idea that he's going to have some sort of moment of moral clarity, you know, as a result of his wife or his kids or his advisors is just a fantasy. The only thing that will stop this president from conducting himself in this way is if it stops working. And the only way it will stop working is if we beat him.
What were your thoughts when you heard about the shooting at the synagogue?
It was personal. You know, every time there's a shooting in a church or a school, it shocks the conscience and makes you sad and makes you pause. But obviously, as a Jew, I actually pictured the shooting in a different way, just visually. I imagined it. It's good that we're having a service at Temple Emmanuel, but I think it's more important that this is a collection of people who are Jewish and non-Jewish saying we don't stand for this, that this is not who we are as Americans and also as Hawaii citizens. This is not who America is, and we have to stand against anti-Semitism, racism, white supremacy, Nazism. Right now, the best way to get to a sort of recalibration is that what the Republicans are doing in the closing days of this election has to be rejected. It has to stop working politically, because as long as it works politically, they will keep doing it. And I think that there's always room, including on my, you know, in my own life and in my own rhetoric and in my on my own Twitter feed, to take a breath and to say, is this exactly what I want to say and how I want to say it? I mean, I did something yesterday, which I won't repeat because I don't want to repeat it, but I had to take it back. I thought about it and I thought, you know what, this is not really what I meant to say or the way I wanted to say it. And so I just took it back. And I think there's always room to evaluate the extent to which we're contributing to a toxic environment. But I don't want to have a false equivalence here. There is a political party led by Donald Trump that is feeding into this racism and toxicity. There is another political party which is totally imperfect and screwed up in lots of ways, but that is not feeding into racism and toxicity. We all have a role to make our country a better place, our community a better place. But in my view, we don't want to equivocate about what's actually happening in the country, which is that Donald Trump in 2018 is tweeting out a pretty much explicitly racist ad as his closing message. Not healthcare, not tax cuts, not deregulation, not anything else, but just be afraid of people who don't look like you. And that, I think, has to be rejected by everybody left, right, and center.
And then I do have to ask, we have been talking with FEMA and HAIMA emergency management personnel, and they have some concern about federal funding, that somehow Hawaii could get shortchanged because of the low numbers that appear on FEMA's worksheets. What can you share about the status of funding?
So we're working very hard with the Appropriations Committee and with FEMA and HUD and Department of Agriculture and others to make sure that those numbers are as robust as possible. And the basic problem is that, especially as it relates, not so much the floods, but especially as it relates to the lava flows, if you have an intact house, FEMA tends to book that as zero loss. But if that intact house is surrounded by lava or adjacent to a lava flow, it's unusable and needs to be written off. So FEMA and HUD have sort of never dealt with this problem before. We're confident that they're going to be able to work through it. We've been in constant conversations with them about finding a new way to account for this, but that's the problem. So the number right now that they're able to book is super low. We are cautiously optimistic that it won't end up super low. And our request will reflect the actual losses, not their sort of technical hiccup right now. And that's, at least at this stage, that's where we feel we are, which is they want to help us, but they've never done this before. And they have to figure out a way to say, if a house is surrounded by, you know, say, 500 square miles of lava and there's no infrastructure, it is officially a loss, even if it still looks fancy. So once we get those booked, those numbers will quickly ratchet up. And we do hope that the supplemental disaster appropriation will be passed in December. So we're working, this is literally my highest priority after the election, is to try to make sure we maximize the number of federal dollars. I don't have a number for you because a lot of it's formula-based. And some of those damage assessments the calculation of the unmet needs are not in yet. But all of the counties and the state and the Appropriations Committee, everybody's in pretty good contact. And we're not in total agreement, but there's not a lot of resistance. And there's almost zero politics. So we feel pretty good.
Okay. All right. And then we'll see what November 6th brings.
Yes.
All right. Thank you so much, Senator.
Thank you.
On the local election front, Senator Schott says he is against a constitutional convention, fearing the outside money that powerful political action committees may throw into the campaign to try and influence local issues. I'm Catherine Cruz on HPR One. This is The Conversation on Statewide Member-Supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, we test your game skills with our backyard quiz. In today's backyard quiz, a not very friendly creature you'd likely want to be as far away from as possible, a great white shark. Great whites have become famous as a species. Shark films keep recycling on Shark Week, but few individual sharks have gone on to individual fame. The beast we're thinking of this morning is one of those exceptions. It was one of the first great whites to be equipped with a tracking device, and a trip he made to the Hawaiian Islands was a milestone in shark research. There are still many things that scientists don't know about these large and intimidating creatures, and satellite tagging has begun to solve some of the mysteries. The shark we're thinking about this morning started his epic journey in California on December 9th, 2001, near the Farallon Islands at a sea lion breeding area known as a rookery. He then set out for the Hawaiian Islands, usually swimming either within 15 feet of the ocean surface or much deeper at a depth from 1,000 to 1,500 feet. Now, this particular one swam to Ko'olawe and then back to the Farallon Islands and was named by researchers for one of his distinctive features. Do you know this famed shark's name? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Hawaii International Film Festival, presenting the 38th Annual Fall Festival, featuring films from around the world, November 8th through the 18th at Regal Dole Cannery Theaters, hiff.org.
This morning, Ku'uwehi Hiraishi joins us to talk about where things are on the ground when it comes to the lava inundation that we saw in the Big Island. You were just there.
I was just there. I did. It's been 6 months as of last Saturday that this has happened, that this eruption actually took place in Leilani Estates from Kilauea Volcano. So I got to check up on some of the evacuees that I met when I initially went there. And when I met this one in particular, so Leilani Estates resident April Buxton, I met her. She had her tent set up, one of the first in the parking lot of the Pahoa community shelter. And I remember her being very just living in limbo. She didn't know what was going to happen, how long the eruption was going to last. And this was in May. And she spent about 2.5 months at the shelter, later found a shelter with a friend for a couple of months before Leilani Estates actually opened back up and the evacuation order was lifted in September. So she has been home in her home, which has not been lost to lava in sort of upper Leilani Estates, as you would call it. She's been home for about a month now, cleaning out her gutters, getting everything situated, but hasn't fully return to normal. But I talked to her, I got to catch up with her to see how things were going, and this is what she had to say about what's happening on the ground there.
It seemed like right after the first month that this was happening that mainstream media and everybody just kind of went on to the next big story. But you know, the fact is even though this eruption's in a lull, it's still very much active. We have steam vents all over throughout Leilani and across Highway 130. Days of heavy rain, you can smell the sulfur in the air very bad. There's a lot of people still trying to get insurance companies to pay out, still figuring out where they're going to live, where they're going to get the money for that. We're still definitely in full recovery mode here. This is definitely not over and probably won't be for years.
That's right. So Buxton, you know, very much, I think, painting the picture of what's going on for residents in Leilani. So 725 homes lost or covered by lava. And then about a third of Leilani Estates, it's a very large subdivision, is completely covered in lava. So some folks will not be able to return home. April Buxton was one of the fortunate who still had her home intact. But again, getting back up into getting some assistance from FEMA for any repairs necessary. Most of these folks have catchment, water catchment. So cleaning out those catchment tanks to get everything out of there, that's kind of what she's been going through this past month.
And what's the electricity situation?
So some of electricity has been restored to certain portions of Leilani Estates, but not all, of course. And then in other areas, so lava entered the ocean and pretty much landlocked Pohoiki, right? So for example, Pohoiki and all along that sort of that coast, there's not a lot of opportunities for figuring out what to do at this point. And that's sort of the next step for the county at this point to figure out, you know, long term, how are we going to get things back up and running? Because I think for the past 6 months, it's been, how do we get these folks into shelter temporarily to just stabilize the situation? But you heard Buxton talk about the steam and I rising up from both sides of Highway 130. So this is the one of the three main highways out in Pahoa that takes you to Kalapana from Pahoa. And Leilani Avenue comes off of that road. I went there. I drove past there, and it felt like I was in Volcano. You know how the sulfur mm-hmm. banks are there? And I wasn't sure, is this safe when I went out? So I tried to reach out to a USGS geologist, and this is Carolyn Parchetta, who's actually a rift zone specialist herself, eruption specialist. Got to talk to her, ask her all the questions about, okay, how safe is this? How much danger are we in? Are we in any more danger than we were before this eruption? And she said, no, you know, it's the same amount of danger that they have seen this sort of pause in eruption activity. And she kind of explains what that pause is really about.
We lost our driving pressure to force magma out of the ground. So all the stuff that collapsed at the summit has now come down inside the volcano to a similar elevation, and it's no longer able to push lava out at Fissure 8.
Okay.
So that's why this is either a pause or the end, and we're leaning towards this is the end of this eruption, just because we've had a long enough time gap now where typically if an activity is to resume, it would have resumed by now.
That's right. So this pause that she referred to, for as of right now, we're about 2 months into not seeing any activity along that East Rift zone in the area that we've seen this fissure system pop up. And she says typically it's 2 weeks, so 14 to 16 days at the least that we would see a pause, and they would call it a pause. But the longest pause was in 1971 in Maunaulu, which lasted 3.5 months. So there's a possibility of it erupting again. Mm. But as always, they're constantly monitoring the situation in and around USGS's, in and around that East Rift zone every day. In fact, when I met with her, she was going out to check out the cracks to see if they're getting smaller or bigger, but they've got a lot of monitoring in the works. And she says if folks feel earthquakes or any seismic activity or see more steam than usual, those are the kind of signs to trust to know that there's possibly something happening and to get out of there. Got a chance to get some FaceTime with Mayor Harry Kim to talk about where he's at in terms of this sort of next phase of long-term planning. And he talked a lot about this idea of building a new puna, in a sense, much like after the 1961 tsunami in Hilo Town, an entire village was completely wiped off. But instead of rebuilding there, they moved everyone elsewhere and sort of considered this area, you know, in a flood zone and not build here ever again. So it's something along those lines. It will cost a lot of money at this point. He talked a lot about sort of getting, like I said, the electricity, the water, and the roads back up. Those are really the big price tags, I guess, on this recovery effort. But I did get to sit down with him, and he kind of, so he lost his house himself. He bought a house in 71 in Kapoho, which was taken by this recent lava eruption. He talks about sort of his personal situation and going through the idea of what he's going to do with this. Is he going to go ahead and try to rebuild or not? This is what he had to say.
I don't think I'll even ever consider going back, even if I could, because they couldn't afford it. Yeah. The road was private, so that means government will not restore it for you. It means that if you're lucky, maybe you can get FEMA to pay for 75% of the cost, if you're lucky. 25% of $10 million is still a lot of money for people. Yeah. You got to restore your own water. You got to work with the power company, restore power. Mm. Outside of that, for me, and I'm sure it's for me, the most important thing is I bought it because of my touch with the ocean. Mm. Now the ocean is 500 yards away.
That is the situation for Mayor Kim, and I think he's really talking about the complexities that a lot of these residents are trying to grapple with, trying to figure out, do I want to return here? This $10 million price tag that he mentioned, so that was the low lower scale of cost for roads, right? So barging through these lava beds of roads and trying to restore the old roadways would cost anywhere from 10 to 20 million, according to Mayor Kim. And so these are some of the things that, Pune residents are going through right now to figure out what to do next.
That was HPR reporter Ku'uwehi Hiraishi talking about the Big Island's recovery from Kilauea's eruption. You can find her reports online at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Urgent Care Hawaii, walk-in clinics in Pearl City, Kailua, Kapolei, and Waikiki, featuring ZipPass, an online tool to secure a place in line. AmazingUrgentCare.com.
It is now time for our reality check with our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat. Brittany Light has a really cool story about crickets and climate change. Morning, Brittany.
Good morning, Catherine.
So tell us about this. It's really a story about adaptation, isn't it?
It is. Yes. Yeah. So the story is that a scientist who's been studying the Pacific field cricket in the islands here for 15 years, she was in Kalapapa on Molokai and was looking for the cricket. She found it. And she found that it makes a completely different noise than the cricket does anywhere else. Instead of the typical chirpy sound of a cricket, these crickets in this one population on Molokai actually make a sound that sounds similar to the low guttural purr of a cat. She actually started looking around and looking for a cat until she realized the sound was coming from these crickets.
Well, you know, we have a little bit of that audio that you folks have embedded in your website. Let's take a listen. Yeah, that's a difference in tone, isn't it?
Yeah, so the second set of sounds there are representative of the noise that the typical Pacific field cricket makes. And, mm-hmm. and those earlier set of sounds, that's what this new, we're calling it the purring cricket. To me, it almost sounds like a typewriter.
Yes, that's what I thought.
Yeah. So it turns out that we're not really sure what is causing this change. The scientists have a few theories. One is that the preferences of female crickets are changing in terms of the mating call that they like to hear from the male crickets. These songs are made by the males. And so one theory is that the females are responding in a different way. They like to hear different sounds, and the males are adapting to that. Another theory is that there's a fly that is predatory, and it has tapped into the communication of the crickets, and it uses that to locate these male crickets when they're singing to find a mate. And using that, it will come, it will spray the cricket with larvae that actually embed in the body of the cricket and sort of eat the cricket from the inside out.
So,
as a survival technique, it's possible that these crickets are creating a new sound to avoid that sort of terrible death.
Yes, when I read that, it just creeped me out. I was like, ew. I'd change my tune if that happened to me.
I would change my tunes. Yeah, I would change my tune too. And interestingly, these Pacific field crickets, there's another population originally found on Kauai, they've gone silent. So really what this all means is that, you know, this is evidence that animals and plants can adapt to environmental factors, whether it's a new species in the area that's preying on it, whether it's the noise of traffic, whether it's climate change. It's kind of hopeful that some plants and animals can adapt and continue to survive.
Now, she was looking on Molokai initially, but so has she looked at other islands?
She has. She's actually found these purring crickets on Oahu. And there's a field. These crickets like to be in sort of grassy fields, like college campuses. So there's actually one campus up at Brigham Young University on Oahu. And there are, in this one field, there are the purring crickets, the typical crickets, and also the silent crickets. So this scientist wants to come back, do more research, and try to figure out, are we eventually going to have three different distinct species, or will all of this variation sort of settle out, and will these crickets kind of figure out a song that they're all going to be singing and responding to?
Fascinating story. Thanks so much, Brittany.
You're welcome.
That was Sybil Beat's Brittany Light with today's reality check. To read her full story, visit sybilbeat.org.
Join us on November 15th for Listening While Muslim, the B-side. Curator of programs at Shangri-La, Asad Ali Jafri, and hip-hop DJ Naveed Najafi play music from around the globe and share the personal experiences that have influenced and shaped their relationship to music. Tickets at hprtickets.org. Presented by Shangri-La Museum of Islamic Art, Culture, and Design in partnership with HPR Generation Listen.
Today marks 4 weeks since thousands of Hawaii hotel workers walked off the job over a labor dispute against Marriott Hotels that is locked in with other contract talks in other cities. Now, negotiators from the two sides met this weekend in hopes of trying to work out an agreement on a new contract. And this weekend, Mayor Kirk Caldwell joined striking workers on the line.
And I'm hoping in the next couple days you are successful in bringing this strike to conclusion negotiating a contract where you get a wage for one job being enough.
Yeah.
One job being enough.
Yeah.
You know, for me, as mayor, I know that the visitors come here to Waikiki and other parts of our island because of the aloha that you show. And you should only show that aloha if you're rested and have just one job.
Yes.
And many of you are working two and three jobs, getting home at 10 at night and waking up at 4 in the morning just to make enough to live on this island.
That's right.
And we want to see you get a wage where you can have just one job, be at home with your family, rest, and come back and show aloha to our visitors. Mahalo and aloha. Love you all.
Having a dramatic impact on the visitor experience for sure at these five hotels, but also on the experience of visitors in Waikiki. And for me, it is reaching an agreement here, finding some common ground. It's our largest industry. It generates about $17 billion in revenue in the state of Hawaii. And I do think that the people that work in our hotels, they're the folks who bring aloha and the aloha spirit. They need to be paid a fair wage, a wage that would support just one job, and many will have multiple jobs, so that they can focus on their job and show that aloha to the visitor. Without them, we're nothing. We're just another place. We're Miami Beach or some other resort destination. And what makes us special are the people and the soul of the people. And I want to see them treated fairly so they can continue to show that aloha to our visitors.
And I know it's not just the visitors that are affected, but families at Seiwei that were planning weddings at the hotel or, just trying to mark special events like that, they're impacted too.
Yeah, they are. And, you know, even as mayor, I won't cross the picket line. But luckily, every event I've been invited to has now been canceled and moved to somewhere else. So it's having a disruptive impact on not-for-profits that are having fundraisers or private events where they want to celebrate, but they reserved at a hotel that's now on strike. And so it's having an impact on the people wanting to use those facilities. And a lot of those are local folks who are in Waikiki, because that's where the facilities are.
That was Honolulu Mayor Kirk Caldwell making an appearance on the strike line this weekend. Local 5 told HPR that in negotiations over the weekend, progress was made on the issue of job security. On Thursday, both sides will return to the bargaining table to address other matters, including workload and funding of wages and benefits. This is The Conversation. I'm Catherine Cruz. This is The Conversation on listener-supported Hawaii Public Radio. We now check in with Christopher Phillips and Dave Lawrence with your Monday Stargazer.
Stargazer time, our weekly look at the massive universe around our tiny planet. Also, what we can expect to see in our dark island skies. As usual, we are welcoming back Christopher Phillips and his expertise that he offers. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What do you have this week?
Hey, Dave. It's good to be here. So this week, stargazers look out for Saturn in the western sky after sunset with Mars to the south. The moon this week will be passing through its new moon phase. This, of course, means skies will be nice and dark in the islands and perfect for stargazing.
Now, there was some big news in the astronomy world this week, and I'm hoping you have more on the loss of the Kepler.
That's right. We finally bid farewell to the Kepler Space Telescope. This remarkable space observatory has finally run out of fuel, and its mission to seek out strange new worlds has come to an end. Despite setbacks and technical faults, the telescope kept on delivering incredible science up until its final days. We bid farewell to Kepler and celebrate a planet-hunting revolution that lasted almost a decade.
And in all, how many planets did that thing find?
Well, the number of confirmed exoplanets is around 2,000. However, there are many thousands of candidates still buried in its data archives, many of which will no doubt turn out to be confirmed by data analysis over the next few years.
And what was the technology this thing was using? How was it looking for the planets? Because it wasn't really a gigantic telescope. Was it really a matter of where it was placed?
It was a matter of where it's placed and how sensitive it was. Kepler used a method called transit photometry to find alien worlds. This basically means it monitored the brightness of many thousands of stars and looked for tiny variations that would indicate the presence of an orbiting planet.
And the variations must have been really small.
Oh, yeah. In the case of a large planet, the star's brightness can change by as much as 10%, but for a small Earth-sized world, the change could be less than 0.1%. This is the kind of sensitive work that just wouldn't have been possible from the ground.
And I'm thinking you know something about a successor to Kepler.
I do indeed. It's called TESS, the Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite, and it was actually launched back in April. It's already busy searching the skies for strange new worlds in our galaxy. And in 2019, it's set to deliver some incredible science.
Well, we know you'll be having that. And that's for a future stargazer. Christopher Phillips, thank you so much.
You're welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. Catch you next week. And you can find Stargazer at hawaiipublicradio.org.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we talked about how satellite tracking has helped researchers understand the great white shark. Now, specifically, we remembered one in particular whose 2001 journey to Koho'olawe and back from California's Farallon Islands yielded valuable information about the species' migratory patterns. Now, the satellite also sent back some intriguing facts about the way great whites travel. They either swim close to the surface at the depth of about 15 feet or very deep at 1,000 to 1,500 feet. And the shark was named for a distinctive feature. It had a piece missing from its dorsal fin. And we asked you for the name that researchers gave it. The great white in question, a pioneer for his species, was called tip fin. And that is the answer to our quiz for today. And congratulations to Storm and William from Kaneohe. They got that answer right. That's today's quiz. And if you have an idea for one, send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We'll be right back. This past weekend, a new exhibit opened at the Bishop Museum. It's Rapa Nui, Past, Present, and Future. Some know the place as Easter Island, home to giant stone statues, the Moai. Rapa Nui has a special place in Mara Maruni's heart, as that's where she spent time doing fieldwork in archaeology. Now she's head of Bishop Museum's cultural collection. She joined us in the studio to talk about what's in store.
So I've been working on Rapa Nui for, 17 years now, if you can believe that, in archaeology, working very closely with local collaborators there. We've been doing all kinds of different studies, both on Rapa Nui and at Bishop Museum, on some of the collections that are cared for by us at the museum. So my own expertise is in landscape archaeology, and what that means is that I spend a lot of time wandering, in a systematic way, of course, around the landscape, thinking about how people interacted with each other and with the world around them. And so one of the studies that I was involved in was a very large study, island-wide survey of agriculture. And on Rapa Nui, they were very innovative in their approach to agriculture. So just like here in Hawaii, where we had slash-and-burn agriculture as Polynesians arrived, they brought with them all of their canoe plants, especially those very important starches like kalo and uala. Same thing on Rapa Nui, but on Rapa Nui, it's a very different landscape. It's actually a subtropical island located at 27 degrees latitude. And what they did there is they started with slash and burn agriculture, and then through time, they intensified their approach. In doing that, they built rock gardens.
Rock gardens.
Rock gardens.
Explain that.
Okay, so what people did is these are all rain-fed systems. So on Rapa Nui, we don't have permanent streams. So we don't have, you know, things like lo'i and that wetland agriculture. What we have is dryland agriculture. What people did is they moved rocks around on the landscape and they placed them on the landscape, and sometimes they tilled those rocks into the soil. In doing that, it served a variety of functions, the construction of these rock gardens, right? It's a form of what we call intensification, that is putting a lot of effort into a given area of land so that you increase production. So what people would do is place the rocks on the surface. So we have distributions of rocks, and they would protect the plants from winds. So you'd plant your kalo right next to those rocks, right? So you have a nice little puka, right, where it's protected. It also helps to absorb the rainwater and to conserve that water, right? So you have high winds, sort of a cooler environment, and so all of the water is permeating into the soils.
Wow, that's genius.
Yeah, but what's also happening, and this is the part that is just phenomenal, is that those rocks are actually leaching nutrients, right?
Oh.
So the rain falls, it hits the rocks, nutrients are coming out of those basalt rocks, and they're introducing elements like phosphorus to the soils, and that's making them more productive. So what's interesting is that you've often heard the story of Rapa Nui, right? That they cut down all their trees, lost sight of what they were doing, and, quote, self-destructed. Well, by cutting down all of those trees and intensifying their agriculture through the construction of these rock gardens, they actually made the environment more productive. So it takes that story of cultural collapse, of ecological collapse, and it really turns it on its head.
So you must have just loved working on this exhibit.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. So we've been working on developing the exhibit for about the past year and a half or so, working very closely with colleagues on Rapa Nui. And we're really excited because we're also welcoming an exhibit that centers on contemporary arts from Rapa Nui. It's called Ka'u'i, which means to take a deeper look. Right, to look at something more deeply. And it features the works of 8 contemporary artists from Rapa Nui. The wonderful thing is that, you know, technology is such that I can be in very close contact with collaborators on the island. So I've been working with people from around the world, really amassing photographs from the island, and of course, writing all of the scripts and designing the exhibit with our exhibits and production team as well.
And so you folks had to reach deep into the morgue to pull out a number of things to spotlight, because you do have a very deep collection of stuff from Rapa Nui.
Yeah, so we actually have multiple collections from Rapa Nui. Within our ethnology department, we have 815 ta'oa, or cultural treasures. of which we selected over 150 to put on display as part of this exhibit. We've also been working on a large project to document those collections. So we've been photographing them and doing research on them and so on and so forth. Now, in addition to cultural treasures, we have extensive archives from Rapa Nui, especially a lot of photos, which we've also been working on digitizing to improve access. So we've actually just transferred all of the digital files to the local museum on Rapa Nui, and we've been working very closely with them to develop a sister exhibit as well.
Oh, that's fascinating. So really, in addition to kind of bringing this stuff out for display, you're updating it and creating more of a reach to the community around the world, really.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we're also bringing out some natural sciences collections as well. We have a very large collection of specimens in our ichthyology collections.
Where do you keep all this stuff?
Everything's kept on campus at Bishop Museum. We have a number of storage areas where we keep our collections.
That just seems like so crazy to have, you know, that number of fish and all the cultural artifacts.
Yeah, yeah. So with the fish, fantastic story there. Jack Randall, who's our resident ichthyologist, he's now retired but still comes in on occasion to do research. He started working on Rapa Nui in 1969, and he worked very closely with local collaborators, and he described many new species from Rapa Nui. So we've brought out 16 specimens that will be on display, and alongside those specimens, we'll have an interactive component so that visitors can learn a little bit more about them.
And so what makes, I guess, the fish over there so different than what we've got here?
So a lot of them are the same, actually. So we have a lot of the same species, so species that have a very long range. And there's also a lot of endemic species there. So it's second only to Hawaii. Currently, about 21% of the fish that have been described from Rapa Nui in Rapa Nui waters are endemic. But that number is growing. And that number is growing because of new research that's being conducted by Dr. Richard Pyle from the Bishop Museum, as well as his colleagues from around the world. They actually have a rebreather technology, which allows them to dive much deeper. And so, of course, they've been discovering new species, and they think that they've identified based on some submarine footage, but they need to go and actually collect a couple of specimens. They think they've identified some sister species that are found in Papahanao Mokuakea.
Oh, that's pretty neat.
Yeah.
Wow, so it really does... you're just learning stuff all the time. It's not just a matter of dusting off some, you know, old artifacts and pulling them out, you know, for display.
No, these collections are very active. They are accessed by cultural practitioners, by artists, by researchers from around the world on a daily basis. So they're very much alive.
Now, because you've studied Rapa Nui, was there anything that surprised you in putting this all together?
I mean, everything's full of surprises. Life is full of surprises, right? Overall, I learned a lot because I'm an archaeologist. So, you know, I have my little area of expertise or knowledge. But just learning about the fish, for example, was a fantastic experience. And, of course, working with people from various agencies, working with the folks at NOAA here in Hawaii, you know, updating our map of marine protected areas, one of which was just established on Rapa Nui last year. So, you know, in putting that into a global context, just sort of opening your eyes to that global context and learning a little bit more.
And now, what about the Moai?
Mm-hmm.
And I've been reading stories about climate change and the threats to cultural artifacts.
Mm-hmm.
So what can you share about that?
Yeah, I mean, on Rapa Nui, just as here in Hawaii, they are experiencing the effects of climate change, of course. It's a volcanic island. It's low-lying, but still a volcanic island, so a high island when we compare it to coral atolls, for example. So we do have some coastal inundation happening there. It is affecting the very large ahu, or ceremonial platforms, atop which the moai were erected. And so that is, of course, a challenge that the Rapa Nui community is facing. Another big one is marine debris. Because of Rapa Nui's location within the southern sort of circulation cell, right, in terms of the currents, a lot of marine debris is arriving to the island. And actually, there'll be a documentary that's going to debut at the Hawaii International Film Festival that's called Eating Up Easter. and it centers on the theme of sustainability and follows a few Rapa Nui people who are really being proactive about how they're dealing with these challenges of things like waste, right, and recycling in an island environment, you know, keeping in mind that Rapa Nui, it's actually smaller than the island of Niihau.
Wow.
So a very small island, you know, huge impacts of visitors to the island. They're up to about 120,000 visitors per year, right? So at any given time, there are more visitors than there are residents on the island. There's a population of about 8,000 people who call Rapa Nui home.
Wow, so that's really amazing. I mean, the snapshot. So you folks are kind of coming at it at all different angles.
All different angles, yeah, really. So the exhibit does span, you know, past, present, and future throughout, which I think is quite wonderful. You know, it's not sort of focused on the past, although, of course, we explore the Moai and the wonderful cultural heritage of Rapa Nui, but also the living culture, right, and the future of that island.
That was Bishop Museum's Mara Malroney, curator of the exhibit Rapa Nui, Untold Stories of Easter Island, currently on display through May of next year. And there's an added bonus if you go and see that documentary that she mentioned. Hang on to your Eating Up Easter stub and receive discounted admission to the museum.
Support for The Conversation comes from Mattson, in appreciation of HPR's local public affairs programming. Since 1882, working to support Hawaii's economy and communities. Mattson.com.
Ron Artis II is one of Hawaii's best-kept secrets, but he's been making waves on the mainland with his blues, gospel, soul, and R&B originals. On Friday, November 9th, Ron comes home for a special evening in HPR's Atherton Studio. Reserve your seats now at hprtickets.org. Station members enjoy discounted pricing. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
We have to go, but up tomorrow, we'll be talking with the native Rapa Nui producer and director of the film Eating Up Easter. It'll premiere at the Hawaii Film Festival this week. And we'd like to hear from you. Call our talkback line. Leave your comments. Here's that number, 808-792-8217. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow, won't you, for more of The Conversation.